Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. Oh, but sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Oh, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Michael Wald, and you're listening to Ask the Blood Detective. For those of you who are new to the show, I've been nicknamed the Blood Detective years ago by a grateful patient's husband because I found a condition in his wife that was left undetected for many years. And how I do that is by my blood detective method. In short, the method is extremely complete. I run laboratory and assessment tests that look at the entire body or as much of it as I can do so that I could see the entire puzzle rather than just pieces, which is more characteristic of traditional medicine or allopathic medicine. I don't have a particular criticism of the efforts of allopathic medicine except to say that I think there is a better way and other ways to complement allopathic approaches. And my bias, and I freely admit that I have it, is in the nutritional and natural health area. Now, today's show is all about breast cancer. I won't be spending a lot of time at all on the specific types of chemotherapy, other than to mention that chemotherapy and radiation and surgery are the mainstay of oncological care for breast cancer today. But what I will be focusing on is many of the nutritional approaches to breast cancer as adjuncts to traditional therapy, or that many people have chosen to do in lieu of traditional therapies. My role as a practitioner is not to make that judgment for people whether or not they should avail themselves of the standard of care as it's known in medicine for breast cancer, or they choose non-traditional things like natural medicine, which is sort of funny because the concept of traditional really says, you know, what's been around for a long time, and that really is natural medicine. So allopathic medicine is sort of the new medicine, and it is so new. Unlike nutritional medicine, foods, for example, and the role of stress and lifestyle factors such as what we're eating, those are traditional things. One could consider nutritional supplements as new. And the concept of the use of nutritional supplements for cancer care is something I'll be focusing heavily on here. I personally do not believe that diet, no matter how clean or arranged it is to meet the needs of a particular person with breast cancer, it will fall short in many nutritional areas. One of the reasons for that, and let's take vitamin D, for example, is that we need a certain dose in the blood, a certain concentration in the blood of vitamin D for it to have anti-cancer effects and for it to have treatment effects in various diseases, including cancer. There are quite a number of studies that have demonstrated that certain concentrations in vitamin D in the blood, and these are concentrations, by the way, that are just not achievable by eating vitamin D-rich foods or getting sun exposure, it just cannot work for reaching these therapeutic levels, must be accomplished by the use of pharmaceutical-grade, pure nutritional supplements. Perhaps another show I'll focus on foods versus supplements, comparing and contrasting them and how they may work together or whether or not one is better than the other, but for today, suffice it to say that I will be including nutritional supplements as a heavy basis for the nutritional care of those with cancer, for prevention, and also treatment. For those of you new to the show, once again, my name is Dr. Michael Wald, and I have been nicknamed the Blood Detective because I simply do not give up looking for natural solutions for my patients. I run a variety of assessment tests, have those that seek me out complete detailed questionnaires. We go through a very complex consultation so that I could look at the entire individual, the entire you, and not just a piece of it. I also go beyond the standard of care in nutritional medicine through my blood detective analyses and perspective, and that I do not use standard protocols for people, at least not often. So what that means is if you open up a book on natural medicine and it has a list of foods and supplements, let's say for breast cancer, the fact that that is in a book tells you that it's not made for you or anyone in your life that may have breast cancer. Those may be good points or places to start either for you or your healthcare practitioner in terms of figuring out what your actual personal needs are. You know, breast cancer is just a diagnosis. Like all diagnoses, it's just a term. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the form of cancer that a woman may have. And of course, men may have breast cancer as well. And everything I say today will apply to men for breast cancer as well as women. But a diagnosis itself does not tell us what's in the background in that individual. What are their genetic propensities towards breast cancer? What is their current diet? What is their absorption or malabsorption issues, if any? What other health problems do they have that may impact their nutritional needs in the context of their cancer care? This is probably why I see so many people over the last 26 or so years practicing natural health care that are baffled when they do not get results from their efforts. They'll say, Dr. Wald, I have read every book on breast cancer. I followed the protocols. I've taken the supplements. I've seen nutritional experts. My breast cancer spread. Why is that? How is that possible? Well, the first thing that strikes me is how some individuals have such a faith in nutrition. And I think that's wonderful on one level, of course. I share that. Having been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was 18, I'm 50 years old now, I run marathons, I lift weights, I've never taken a medication for MS, I've done it all naturally. So I understand firsthand that having faith in nutrition and really doing it right could make, you know, all the difference in one's life and quality of living. But nutrition cannot cure everything, and neither can medicine. And many people assume, first of all, even if they took the right supplements, or ate the right way, that they absorb all of that. If you malabsorb, well, your efforts are pretty much blunted. If you are taking nutritional supplements that are not pharmaceutical grade, or you're taking combinations of very good things that simply don't work well together for you, well, these are some of the reasons. But what it really comes down to in these cases where people are just baffled why nutrition has not worked for them, or maybe it's worked to a certain extent, just not enough, is that it is then time to take a look at your biochemical individuality. The concept of biochemical individuality is essential for nutrition in every area of health and disease prevention and treatment. And it's really the same, or at least should be the same in medicine, where the treatments and medications, procedures and practices should match the biochemical uniqueness of the person. Another way of saying it is that each person needs what they need, and it may be very different than someone else. Now, we all know that. We all give lip service to that concept because when you think about it, it's pretty much common sense. Of course, we need what we need, and it is very different than others, maybe extremely different than others. But today's show will discuss how different. So for those of you who have questions for me, either during the show or after the show, or want to see me as a patient, I could see you in person, of course. I'm in Westchester in Mount Kisco. Our number is 914-242-8844, and the website address is www.integratednutritionny.com or www.blooddetective.com. You can email me your questions and concerns at info@integratednutritionny.com or info@blooddetective.com. So let's get back to breast cancer. Breast cancer is an all-inclusive term that really represents several types of ways in which breast cancer can occur and behave. And we know that women represent the majority of who gets breast cancer, but men, as I've said, also get breast cancer in all of its forms. The term cancer involves an abnormal growth or proliferation of cells. And proliferation is a fancy term for abnormal growth, too many cells copying themselves, simply too much. So as the abnormal growth of cells continues, the cancer can change its location, it spreads, and that term is called metastasis. So metastasis is the spreading of breast cancer. Now, depending upon the behavior of the cells and where it spread, you know, how aggressive it is, there are various descriptive terms applied to the individual with a particular type of cancer. And in just a moment, I'll talk about those different terms. Now, most breast cancer begins in the ducts of the breast, you know, those ducts that carry mother's milk. And the main forms of cancer include the following. So for those of you who want to take notes, this is the time. I will be posting notes on the show as well on my blog. In fact, all of the radio shows that I've done on Ask the Blood Detective are located on my blog section of the website, which I just gave earlier. So the main forms of cancer include carcinomas, and this is breast cancer that begins in the lining of the breast, known as the epithelial cells. Most breast cancer is either ductal or lobular, beginning in the epithelial layer of these tissues. Now, what's important to know about that is that there are a number of nutrients and nutritional and natural compounds in foods that can target the epithelial layer of cells. For example, zinc, vitamin A, curcumin, vitamin D. Then another form of breast cancer is adenocarcinoma. Now, this term refers to breast cancer that begins in the glandular tissue of the breast. Glandular tissues are those tissues that secrete secretions, such as those produced by the breast itself. Another form of breast cancer is known as carcinoma in situ. Now, this term describes a form of cancer that's confined to the layers of the breast cells where it originally started. And this type of cancer, the cancerous cells have not invaded other tissues, so it's localized or in situ. And then another form of breast cancer, one of the major forms, is invasive or infiltrating breast carcinomas. Now, this term describes breast cancer that's gone beyond the original layer which it started. And most cases of breast cancer are invasive carcinoma, and they tend to move into the invasive ductal areas, or they are known as invasive lobar carcinomas. And the last major group of breast cancer are sarcomas. And this form of breast cancer starts in the connective tissue of the breast, such as the muscle or the fat or the blood vessels themselves. And that's the rarest form, the sarcoma. Now, remember, you can re-listen to this show. And if this is really a topic that concerns you, or maybe there's a family or friend that is concerned about their predisposition to breast cancer or the current breast cancer, perhaps they're undergoing treatments currently, they'll want to listen to this show. It's an hour long, and that's not too long given the amount of information I'm going to pack into this show. Plus, there are my notes, as I said, on the blog. Why don't I discuss right now some of the reasons that women and men are predisposed to breast cancer. These are not all of the reasons, but they are certainly the major ones. The first reason, and these are not in any particular order of predisposition, by the way, but one is genetic predisposition. Now, genetic predisposition to breast cancer only accounts for less than 1% of breast cancer development. But nonetheless, in this 1%, the BRAA genes strongly influence breast cancer development. So if someone has that gene, they are very, you know, it's pretty much guaranteed that at some point in their life they'll get breast cancer. Now, most individuals test negative for cancer genes, which proves that the environment, along with what are called non-specific genetic influences, meaning not those genetic glitches that are hardwired like the BRAA gene. So some non-specific genetic influences determines one's risk, meaning that if you look at all the other women that don't have the BRAA gene, they are clearly predisposed to breast cancer, but not because of that gene, but because of other genes that have been damaged or together as a group open up their predisposition. Those are called epigenetic effects. And those are strongly influenced by diet and nutritional supplements. The next predisposing factor to breast cancer, or any disease really, is poor diet. The intake of refined and processed sugars has increased over the last few hundred years. The one's overall meat intake, a meat-based diet, which is very pro-inflammatory, loaded with potential pro-carcinogens such as growth hormones and antibiotics, not to mention many other chemicals. It's not just the amount of meat we're eating now, but the meat itself is just not what it used to be. Smoked and charcoal broiled meats and fish significantly increase disease risk and absolutely increase breast cancer risk. Now, lack of exercise is another predisposing factor. Exercise impacts detoxification in the liver, and the liver is where estrogens are detoxified. So this is the first time I've mentioned estrogens, but estrogen, particularly the estradiol form of estrogen, is a known pro-carcinogenic factor. And as a former biochemistry professor of mine said, that if you live long enough as a woman, if you have exposure to higher levels of estrogens or normal levels of estrogen, but too much estradiol, and if your cells are too sensitive to it, you'll get breast cancer. What baffles me in medicine is that we know that estrogen, particularly the estradiol, predisposes to breast cancer and actually can cause it. But if a woman who gets breast cancer happens to be on birth control pills, many doctors ignore it. It makes no sense. But exercise increases the ability of the liver to detoxify estrogen. And estrogen is specifically metabolized in a certain phase of liver detoxification. So here's also the first example that I'm describing to you of how we all know about detoxification, nutritional detoxification. But if you listen to my show, Detox Deception, you'll see that there's a lot of nonsense floating around in the so-called detox area. I review in detail what physiologists know are the main detox pathways in the body. The reason we want to know these is that in the case of estrogen, if we know that estrogen is detoxified or dismantled or made less toxic in phase two liver detoxification, and we further know that there are specific nutrients that help phase two detox work, we'd want to take those. They don't include a water fast or lemons. They don't include a bunch of non-specific herbs, but they do include many herbs and nutrients that are specific. So you could listen to that show for that. Now, when I deal with an individual with breast cancer, I test in great detail their nutritional needs. I am mindful of what I know of the nutritional requirements of phase two detox, for example, but I do not treat people like textbooks. I've written many books, over 10 books, including a very well-selling encyclopedia of anti-aging lab tests. It's over 500 pages. It's the only book on the market that I'm aware of that thoroughly reviews dozens and dozens of lab tests and the nutritional and medical implications. But even that book is not written for you. It's not written for an individual. It's information that helps you make better choices. Another predisposing factor to breast cancer, in addition to genetic predisposition and poor diet or lack of exercise or not the proper exercise, which improves the detoxification of estrogens, are wearing a tight bra. Now, this isn't scientifically proven, but some have suggested that tight bras compress the lymphatic system. And we all know how important the lymphatic system is for getting out toxins. Now, some of those toxins could be spent or used up estrogens in the body. So the body makes its estrogen, it uses it, and then it wants to get rid of it. And it eventually gets into the colon for elimination through the stool. And the lymphatic system dumps into the colon and has other indirect connections for elimination. But if the lymphatic system is hampered somehow or compressed by a tight bra, and by the way, the breasts have a very rich lymphatic system that goes from one breast to the other, there's a direct connection, then we're going to have a problem. So I think it's reasonable for women to not wear tight bras, whether scientific studies have been done or not. You know, the problem with scientific studies is that they're studies. They are based on averages. They are not based on individuals. I'm not saying they're useless. But once again, they're good for informing one of a concept and some specifics, but they should not be mistaken with, at least what I do, comparing an individual to themselves with testing, symptom signs, all of that, and making sure that they actually get helped. And another predisposing factor is environmental chemical exposures. Now, environmental plastics from industry, heavy metals in the air, in food such as fish, for example, water, and other chemicals in the environment may mimic estrogens or affect the immune system in such a way that it drastically impacts the development of breast cancer and many other diseases. The toxic heavy metal cadmium, for example, that's cadmium, which you'll find in cigarette smoke, and it's very rich in the environment, stimulates estrogen receptors. That is not a good thing to stimulate an estrogen receptor when you're worried about breast cancer. The breast cancer cell line known as MCF7, we know, is induced. In other words, the growth of those MCF7 cancer cells are increased about 5 to 6 times just due to cadmium exposure. How an oncologist or even a pediatrician, meaning when we start out young, if we know certain, you know, something about the environment and our predisposition to cancers, we might make some changes like not smoke or try to offset air pollution or exposure to secondhand smoke. Or, in other words, there are things we can do. Unfortunately, most of the time, we learn these things very late, but there's almost always something that can be done about it. The removal of cadmium is a very specific process. It's not done with some generic detoxification method. There are certain detoxifiers, or what are known as chelators. The term chelate is from the Greek term claw, or to grab on to a toxin. There are chelating medications or chelating nutrients that are specific for different types of heavy metals. Another risk factor are birth control pills and hormone replacement therapy. So we know that oral contraceptives, according to many studies, increase the risk of a breast cancer and also cervical cancer, even liver cancer, for example, according to the National Cancer Institute and many other studies. If a woman comes to see me and she's concerned about the potential for her hormone replacement or her oral contraceptives increasing her risk, but has a strong enough reason, at least in her mind, to stay on them, then I work on the diet and nutritional supplements to support those pathways in the body that might mitigate the estrogen effects. So sometimes it's possible to have your cake and eat it too, so to speak. Another risk factor for breast cancer are infections, you know, like Epstein-Barr virus. Various infections, whether or not they are parasitic or bacterial and viral, can disrupt immune system function, and in that way predispose a person to not only breast cancer, but many different diseases. The sex steroids in particular, by the way, alter the expression of the immune system and our susceptibility to infections, and therefore our susceptibility to breast cancer, which clearly is more predominant in women. Hormonal problems, or what are known as endocrine problems, including what is known as hyperparathyroidism, when the parathyroid glands, those are glands located on both sides of the thyroid, when they work too much, they will cause an accumulation of calcium, and that'll be measured in the blood as a high level of calcium, and it doesn't have to be too high. You know, when calcium levels go up due to too much parathyroid function, calcium finds its way into many different tissues. For example, when calcium levels increase in the blood, the body wants to put that calcium somewhere. So it'll stick it in breast tissue, and it could form what are called calcium-laden breast cysts. So when OBs, for example, find these calcium deposits, they generally tag them. They'll ask the patient to come back in around 6 months, because 6 months is about the doubling time of breast cancer, to see what's happened with that. So not everyone with calcium-laden breast cysts develops breast cancer, but it is a very strong predisposing factor. The calcium might also go into joints, causing arthritis. It might deposit into blood vessels, causing arterial sclerosis or hardening of the arteries. And all of these problems seem to be associated with more bone loss. The calcium needs to come from somewhere. And weaker bones seem to be much more susceptible, it's thought, to metastatic spread. They're just easier to run through by cancer cells. There are so many things nutritionally that can offset that problem. But I should say at this point, I guess here comes the disclaimer, folks, that nothing that I say in the show should be misunderstood as a single treatment for breast cancer or any disease for that matter. You must always work with a qualified health professional, preferably one who is a board certified in nutrition, who is a licensed nutritional professional that's gone through some standard education and not, you know, merely weekend seminars. And it is also very responsible for each of us to know what the standard of care is, not just for breast cancer, but for everything else, so you can make the proper decision. Another predisposing factor is stress. You know, anything in life in terms of stress will increase our susceptibility to disease. Stress can lower one's immunity. Stress can derange organ function and increase nutritional requirements. So many ways that stress can impact us, and I certainly will have an entire show on the different forms of stress, the good stress, the bad stress, and how to manage it. But for now, please accept that stress and lowering stress in your life is exceedingly important. And I'll be discussing in an upcoming show about the use of languaging and internal perceptions and thought processes towards managing external stressors, because stress is really not something that exists in the world or outside of ourselves. It exists in our conversations, in our mental structure, in our mental states. Now, let's move on to cancer treatments. I'm often asked what treatments I feel are most effective for breast cancer. The best treatments, in my opinion, to treat breast cancer involve, particularly when it's gotten out of hand with metastatic spread, involve the combination of chemotherapy, perhaps radiation, and perhaps surgery by oncologists, and the nutritional part done by a qualified nutritional specialist. Now, remember what I said earlier. I do see women who have decided not to receive the standard of care, and that is their choice. I will make sure that they know very thoroughly what is available to them in traditional medicine. So I do treat people with just nutritional therapies. Those nutritional therapies are best meant to support traditional treatments and to offset or mitigate side effects of chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. And I make it my goal to assess that person's biochemistry in a very detailed way, because if we can find out the right nutritional levels and the right form of nutritional supplements and foods for that person, it will, in my opinion, and the opinion of many scientific studies, improve survivability and quality of life. And there's no doubt that chemotherapy and radiation has drawbacks. Chemotherapy is generally immunosuppressive. It is known to increase the risks of various cancers, depending on the chemotherapy itself, and reduce quality of life in a number of ways. Yes, it might increase quality of life as well, but it is a mixed bag, to say the least. So this will not be a political discussion on the use or not using the standard of care. I'm here to provide a conversation about what we can do nutritionally to manage breast cancer, regardless of what choice a woman makes in terms of overall care. But what I should make very clear is that chemotherapy and radiation have very serious side effects often. They will reduce immunity, as I mentioned, increasing risk of infection. They will increase our predisposition to malnutrition. And oncologists will tell you that many people do not die of their cancers. They die of the secondary effects of the treatment for the cancer, which are those infections I just mentioned and undernutrition, two things that nutrition is essential to help offset. You know, my 26 or so years of clinical experience using various natural and nutritional therapies, which include foods and various vitamins and minerals and herbs, have proven to me that these sorts of treatments are very powerful adjuncts, reducing the side effects of traditional therapies, improving the quality of life, and therefore extending lifespan, as a person will, let's say, in certain cases, survive their cancer. Now, unfortunately, oncologists are not trained in nutrition. According to my research, the average medical physician has roughly 35 or so hours of nutritional training in all of their years. And this is one of the reasons why when you ask a traditional oncologist, what do you think of nutrition, they will say, don't do it. It can hurt you. I even had one oncologist tell a patient that it'll cause their cells to explode. These statements are exceedingly ignorant to the point of malpractice, in my opinion, given the evidence base for the use of nutrition. But it is what it is, and I tell those who work with me to try to focus less on, you know, why their doctors are not supporting them, and focus on themselves. On the other hand, I have studied with and done lecture series all over the country and abroad with oncologists who are open-minded to nutrition, although I am not aware of any oncologists that provide the type of nutritional detail that they should. But it is slowly changing over time, very slowly changing. I wouldn't wait for it, folks. I would take some action on your own. Let me talk a bit more about prevention of breast cancer. And these tips are important, I think, for everyone. Things like avoiding, you know, becoming overweight or obese, because, you know, fat tissue is a major source of the pro-cancerous hormone estrogen. I said this earlier, I need to say it again. Now, for those of you that do not think you're overweight, you might be over fat. I met with a gentleman yesterday, like many people I meet, men and women, that appear to be of normal weight. But when I do a test known as a body composition test or a bioimpedance test, I find that they are what I euphemistically call thin fat people. They have too much internal fat, and this fat generates lots of estrogen. And the importance of a body composition test, I cannot overemphasize. Every single patient that I see, I recommend a body composition test. Simply because, and I've talked about this in practically every single show I've done, will tell you what your metabolic rate is. If you do not know your metabolic rate, you cannot know the calories you need. If you do not know your percentage of muscle, water, and fat in your body, or at least if your healthcare provider does not, then you can't know how much of your diet and your caloric needs should be in the area of healthy fats, healthy carbohydrates, or proteins. If you don't get that right and you take a bunch of nutritional supplements on top of a faulty diet, even though you might think it's healthy, you're also missing the mark, and it can make all of the difference. Now, as far as exercise, no less than 2 hours per week at a moderate pace. You know, and this is, of course, based on your average heart rate, which can be measured in a with a heart monitor, will tell you how you should be exercising. But exercise, of course, like everything else in life, should be based on your needs. The type of exercise, the intensity of it, the frequency, all must be tailored to you. In terms of diet, I mentioned before the intake of refined and processed foods and sugar, which, by the way, fruit sugar in the form of the actual physical fruit is a good thing. Many people misunderstand that they think sugar is sugar across the board, and somehow that table sugar, sucrose, and glucose, these so-called bad sugars, which I would agree in general are, and most of us consume nearly 200 pounds annually of these bad sugars, are the same as fructose that is found together with all the phytonutrients, fibers, minerals, and all the other still unidentified health factors in fruit are the same as simple sugars. They are not. I absolutely will be doing a show on the truths and myths about sugar. But for now, we know that the higher intake of fruits and vegetables, the lower your risk of most diseases, particularly when you've started these habits earlier in life. So one of the reasons that I've developed certain nutritional supplements, like my detox powders, detox 1, 2, 3, and 4, these four products are dehydrated concentrates of dozens and dozens and dozens of pieces of fruits and vegetables. So a few scoops of this a day, in addition to your diet, I believe gives you quite a bit of nutritional insurance, so to speak. The intake of the charcoal broiled foods, that should be gone. Fried foods, gone. I should also mention that gluten is I think is bad for everyone. And my book, Glutenaholic, will be up on my website soon for download. GMOs, genetically modified organisms or foods, are horrible for human health, in my opinion. And that's why I've written a book known as Frankenfoods that's available either through my office or on Amazon, which describes that. Now, The diet these days is getting quite complicated, as you can imagine, all these things we need to eliminate. But it really doesn't have to be difficult. When I sit down with an individual and identify their needs, I then figure out a doable lifestyle plan for them. It must be doable, because if it's not, it's useless. So try not to become overwhelmed with this information. Just take it in your right brain today, which is your creative brain. And then you'll read the notes or listen to this talk or see me or someone like me at some point that will help you make this doable for you. Hormone replacement therapies. Since 2002, it's been known that postmenopausal women, for example, who took hormones were at higher risk for developing breast cancer. Once a postmenopausal woman stops taking hormones, her risk drops back to average, but only after she stopped for about 5 years of discontinuing the hormone therapy. So if that is your scenario, that gives us an opportunity to try to make up for lost time during that 5-year period and thereafter. In my opinion, women should avoid as much as possible any synthetic hormone replacement, such as birth control pills, or even natural hormones. You know, natural hormones are still not your hormones. And although they're natural, they still are hormones. They may have weaker effects than the synthetics. But if you're predisposed or concerned about cancer risk, I think twice about natural hormones as well. And that doesn't mean they don't have their uses in healthcare. So I need you to hear that. There may be something in natural medicine or regular medicine that is considered overall maybe unhealthy for most, but may have a place in certain areas. Let me now talk about what are known as hormone disruptors or parabens. Parabens are a class of chemicals that are endocrine or hormone disruptors. They're found in 98% of grains, about 91% of fish and shellfish, about 87% or so of dairy products, about 85% of fruits. When you eat these that are in the organic forms, obviously the levels of parabens are zero or near zero. So that's very important. But sadly enough, the FDA lists them as, in their generally recognized as safe, or their GRAS categorization as safe. But in 2006, the European Food and Safety Authority declared that parabens should no longer be used in food. So we need to realize that our country may be very much behind others. Now, continuing with things to avoid, again, I have said a few times that charbroiled meats and their consumption dramatically increase the risk of breast cancer and several other cancers. Red and processed meats as well, you want to eliminate them or at least limit them from your diet. Avoid artificial colors and sweeteners. Now, in terms of nutritional supplements, I just want to quickly mention two things before I talk about supplements later on, but everyone should be on an activated multivitamin. That is not a multivitamin that you've heard is really, really good from some company, but it's a vitamin that has activated ingredients in it, meaning that they have been converted to the forms that are easy for the body to use, and they should probably not contain iron unless you are iron anemic. Iron itself is a cancer promoter in excess. That doesn't mean you shouldn't take iron if you have anemia. I've had patients misunderstand that point. That's an example of something, iron, which is absolutely essential for building up hemoglobin in the body, which we need for oxygenation, but in excess can cause heart disease, cancer, and other problems. So, you know, the future of cancer treatment, that's interesting. You know, so what does the future of cancer treatment hold? So I'm supposed to say something like, take your supplements, eat your food, you should be good, keep it to yourself, don't tell your oncologist. I'm not going to say that. What I want to say is, if you trust your oncologist, let them know what you're doing. Your oncologist may disagree, but if there's mutual respect, then you will be able to do what you need to do. If your oncologist says to you, well, I am concerned of the use of nutritional supplements with my treatments, ask, well, what specific nutrients are you concerned about? Because Chemotherapy, there are many types, and some nutrients improve the effects. They are synergistic, in other words, of chemotherapy, and others may actually reduce the effects of chemotherapy if that's how you choose to do things. Certain foods like grapefruits, for example, interfere with how many, many drugs are used. So you can see how it may be important to share this information, certainly with your nutritionist. And your nutritionist could talk with your oncologist. I've talked to many oncologists regarding nutritional areas, and these are very well-intentioned individuals, by and large. They just have no clue about nutrition. Now, if I didn't have a clue about something, and that happens often, I admit it, I look it up. If I cannot become expert at that, I seek out the health of an expert, and I try to put that together for my patients. But, you know, sadly, a survey of medical schools in the United States determined that less than 35 hours of nutritional education are found in the average 7-year medical curriculum. And at best, the education is very basic. And by the time a medical student becomes an oncologist, hematologist, they're hopelessly out of date with nutrition. Now, let's talk about how to choose the right nutritional products. Number one, nutrition should be chosen based on the specific type of cancer, your stage of cancer, whether you want to prevent cancer, whether you want to prevent cancer and you have a very strong genetic predisposition, whether you want to prevent cancer and you do not have a strong predisposition, what other health problems you may have, what other medications you may have, what other nutrients you may be taking, what stress you are under, what are your environmental exposures. As you can guess, there are many, many factors to consider when choosing the right nutritional supplements and food and healthcare plan, whether it's for breast cancer or something else. Now, I base most of my nutritional needs on a few factors. Number one, experience. I've been doing this for 26 years. I've seen a lot. Number two, the medical literature. The National Library of Medicine has nearly 3 million study abstracts from the nutritional and scientific literature on everything you can name. And this is meant for health professionals. I go on that database on a daily basis. And relative to a particular individual who is before me, I make sure that I'm continually researching and keeping up to date on the very latest things. So there's experience, there is research relative to the individual, and then looking at that research as what it is. It's not based on the person in front of me. I have to figure out through lab testing what patients need, what a person needs. So in a little bit of time, I'll be reviewing my top tests. But again, these are just guidelines, but they are tests that I do on practically every person that I'll help that help determine their nutritional needs. The type of breast cancer, as I said, the extent of it matters. Many people say to me, Dr. Wald, I'm eating this way and I'm taking these supplements because I have breast cancer. Well, certain nutritional supplements work best at certain stages of cancer. If there's severe metastatic spread, we're going to be thinking about modified citrus pectins, for example, and sodium bicarbonate, and there's many other things. And when it is earlier on, there's a whole other set of considerations. So this is what makes the difference. A little knowledge can go a very, very long way. And I go further. My Blood Detective philosophy is a brand. It's a nickname I was given, as you all know. And I think about it often because it drives me to keep on looking. That's what a detective does. But I went further and I had a software program developed, which is called, guess it, Blood Detective. And what that computer program allows me to do is to interpret a large amount of laboratory data very quickly in a way that even the smartest, best-trained clinical nutritionist simply cannot do without the aid of this sort of technology. I also have a theory that comparing someone's biochemistry to a younger version of themselves, a healthier version, or different ranges of blood normalities. For example, vitamin D ranges on the blood or between 30 and 100. But I believe a person should be between 60 and 75, at average 70, for the most reduced morbidity and mortality potential. And in fact, that's what the medical literature shows. A meta-analysis was done, which is a study of all the good studies on vitamin E, and it said, you can't just be normal, you should be at least a 70. In fact, it went further to say, the higher normal your vitamin D, the lower your risk of death from anything, and the higher one's quality of life. So I compare people to different ranges. And I also look at the standard ranges accepted in medicine. We do not have to throw out the baby with the bathwater, as they say. Who made up that say? That's funny. Okay. I will always consider the use of omega-3 fatty acids, particularly the DHA component. And I make a liquid DHA supplement. Research has shown that omega-3s help reduce the hardness or increase the fluidity or softness of cell membranes, allowing different nutrients to get in. Medicine's aware of this too. There's at least one sort of chemotherapy that combines it with an omega-3 fat, except they won't tell you that. I suppose I should say too that whenever you're taking any nutrients that have the potential of blood thinning, like omega-3s or folic acid or boswellia, for example, and if you are on any medical anticoagulants such as Coumadin or warfarin, or aspirin, then you need to be under the care of someone who knows what they're doing, because you can create life-threatening bleeding problems. Then there is active folic acid. So I have in my line of products the active form of folic acid, the L5-methyl tetrahydrofolate form. That helps to regulate a process known as methylation. Low folic acid levels are very common in women with breast cancer, or there could be normal folic acids, but a problem using or activating folic acid, and there are tests that help me figure that out. Some of those tests are known as, one of them is homocysteine, and the other is methylmalonic acid. I do those tests together very often. I will always use a sublingual form of active B12, the methylcobalamin form of B12, at a dose that's appropriate for the person. Boswellia, buffered vitamin C, green tea extract, melatonin, milk thistle, probiotics, trans-resveratrol, vitamin D, my concentrated food products or something similar, the concentrated fruits and vegetable powders. These are mainstays of my therapy with many patients. Also melatonin. If we have time today, I'll be discussing how melatonin is very well known to impact a variety of types of female breast cancer. You know, breast cancer, as I'm sure you understand, is a very complex health problem with no easy solutions. There's no standard protocols for prevention or treatment. But I can tell you that the scientific evidence is mounting so fast, I cannot keep up with it. It is mounting in the area of diet and the impact of environment and stress and lifestyle habits, which of course include foods and nutritional supplements, more about genetics. And it's the use of technology, it's the use of diligence, and applying this information to each individual that will make the difference. I received a few emails asking me to discuss a few other lifestyle choices that might increase one's risk of breast cancer. So I'll cover one or two more. One is multiparity, or being pregnant many times. Being pregnant a number of times reduces the overall risk of breast cancer. Not having children at all or having children later in life carries a much higher risk of developing breast cancer. Women who've had their first child after the age of 30 especially have a higher risk of developing breast cancer. Another factor is breast density. What's known as high mammographic breast density, or HMBD, has been associated with increased breast cancer risk even after adjustment of other risk factors. So we know it's an independent risk factor. There was a large longitudinal study that was first carried out in Mediterranean women suggested that specific dietary components play a role in forming and determining this high mammographic breast density or density changes, that is. Sorry about that. And if a woman does have breast density that is excessive, it is very, very difficult to see breast cancer cells hidden there. That's why I like MRIs. You know, MRIs are non-irradiative, unlike mammography. I'm not saying there's never a place for mammography, but it's been suggested by some researchers that mammography may actually cause more breast cancer than it prevents. But that does not mean that those that are in a high-risk category of breast cancer would not have some, there wouldn't be some value in mammography. And in terms of thermography, which is very big in the natural healthcare field, this is also not something that should be used as a single determinant or in lieu of using either MRI or mammography or sonography. There are lots of issues with thermography, not to mention it tends to be done by individuals who have been certified by non-governmental, there's no real backing to the certification. And when I've questioned some of these individuals, I can tell you they should not be doing the tests. But having said that, even when the tests are done correctly, each of these assessment methods, MRI, mammography, thermography, sonography, are limited, but used in certain combinations may be very, very useful. And if one is concerned about the potential increased cancer risk of radiation, and we do get radiation from mammography, one might consider certain nutrients to offset the ionizing effects of radiation. I did a news interview, which is on my homepage of the website at www.integratednutritionny, which talks about how to mitigate radiation exposure with certain antioxidants, for example. Breastfeeding, another risk factor. Several studies have shown that breastfeeding may lower one's risk of breast cancer in the first place, particularly if the breastfeeding lasts between 1 to 2 years. Breastfeeding also reduces the chances of the babies developing allergies and eczema and other health problems involving their immune system. Breast implants. There's no conversation about breast cancer is complete without at least mentioning breast implants. They may be linked to developing a form of lymphoma. Now, if that's true, why couldn't breast implants eventually lead to other forms of autoimmune diseases? I think they probably can. This is a very controversial area. It has been for a very long time. All I can tell you is anything artificial in your body is probably not a good thing, and that's all I'll say about that right now. Alcohol intake. Alcohol is clearly linked with increased risk of developing breast cancer. Even small amounts of alcohol, even a single drink per day, has been shown to increase one's risk of developing breast cancer. No one exactly knows why that is. But I can tell you this, and this is generally agreed upon, there is no safe level of alcohol consumption that does not increase one's risk of developing breast cancer. Sorry, folks. Smoking will increase the risk of breast cancer. Breathing polluted air will increase the risk of developing breast cancer. Not sleeping or having irregular sleep habits will probably add to the risk of developing breast cancer. Let me end today's show by going through some of the tests that I'd like to do, and then a couple of studies which mention the nutritional supplementation. So in terms of testing, first is the approach. I test in a variety of areas of the body in every person. I look at many of the standard things that your PCP or your internist might perform. I also do tests that some oncologists would perform, endocrinologists, gastroenterologists, doctors of clinical nutrition that have license to do laboratory will perform inflammatory mediators. I check multiple aspects of the immune systems because we have several immune systems. And if we're talking about improving the immune system in someone, well, we need to measure that immune system to see if it's deficient. It might also be working too much. There may be autoimmune issues that predispose to breast cancer, and that needs to be considered as well. So I always do what's called a complete blood count. I always do a chemistry profile. I'll measure homocysteine and what's known as methylmalonic acid tests, vitamin D3 levels, vitamin C levels in the blood along with B vitamin levels, vitamin C levels in the urine, very important. Tests of vitamin C use in the urine, super important. Calcium levels in the urine, again, absolutely essential. Levels of malabsorptive markers and markers of oxidative stress, all of these very important. C-reactive protein, but the specific CRP called cardio. I will run an antibody profile which looks for autoimmune reactions against a variety of tissues. As I've mentioned, I'll measure body composition. I'll run a blood detective report on all of the results that I get, comparing people's chemistries to tighter ranges that I believe allow me to figure out nutrition a bit better. A few more final thoughts on today's topic of breast cancer. The Journal of Integrated Cancer Therapeutics had looked at the studies that relate to the question of whether or not antioxidants interfere with radiation therapy or radiotherapy. And the studies show that not only do they not interfere, the majority or preponderance of evidence show that they do not interfere with radiation or chemo. They are actually protectants. We know that melatonin alongside with radiation treatment helps not just breast cancer, but also brain cancer. I mean, it's amazing the misunderstanding out there and the misinformation. The fact that oncologists do not discuss food or refer their patients, every single patient with breast cancer, to at least a dietitian. I would prefer an alternative type of dietitian because they're very well trained in nutritional supplements. It is a tragedy. We know, based on studies of food intake and nutritional status of women that undergo chemotherapy, and also studies of the diets of women who develop breast cancer, that it is statistically significant that the intake of fruits and vegetables and omega-3 fats reduce the risk of developing and increase overall survival rates. Nutrition has even been shown to improve how many types of chemotherapy and radiation work. There was a study, one of many studies, in the journal OncoTarget that showed that the DHA component that I mentioned earlier of omega-3 fatty acids demonstrated very strong anti-cancer effects, not just for breast cancer lines, but also lung cancer and a few other cancers as well. Tumor growth and metastasis was positively influenced. The specific strains of breast cancer that are the more popular ones were attenuated with DHA. How much and how often and what other nutritional synergies should be taken with it, that is something that I determine based on the studies, but also the individual person's needs, their weight, their body composition, and many other factors. Another study on diet and cancer estimated that 30 to 40% of all kinds of cancer, all of the cancers, not just breast cancer, can be prevented with a healthy lifestyle and specific dietary measures. It's the low use of fiber, the increased intake of red meat, the imbalance of omega-3 to omega-6 fats all increase risk of cancer. On the other hand, consuming lots of fruits and vegetables may lower the risk of cancer. Protective elements in the so-called cancer preventative diet include the right forms and type of selenium and folic acid and B12 and antioxidants and chlorophyll, also lycopene and lutein, and there's many others. Now, for those of you wondering why I'm not giving you a list of supplements with doses, this is an area that cannot be fooled around with. The doses, if you've gained nothing from this conversation today, and the types of nutrients must be determined on a number of factors. And re-listening to the show should make it very clear. I will post the notes as well. So please keep your questions coming in. You are driving the topics that I'm discussing during the Saturday shows. Our next topic, in fact, will be sugar. All about sugar, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I will cover the misconceptions about it. I'm going to pull apart the topic of sugars in a way I promise you have never heard. It's going to turn the alternative healthcare field upside down. I'm not interested in being popular. I'm interested in telling the truth. And during this show, too, I'll present scientific evidence and common sense that should help those of you who already get that sugar is bad. It'll just reinforce that. But it might give you some extra tools that'll help you communicate with others how to improve their diet and lifestyle so that they can live as long as possible, as healthy as possible, as functional as possible. So again, my name is Dr. Michael Wald. Thank you so much for giving me your time and trust. I appreciate it, and I work very hard providing you these shows. For those of you who would like to speak with me about your health, I provide distance consultations with people in other cities and states and even other countries by phone and also in person. The number at my office is 914-242-8844. And again, my website is www.integratednutritionny.com or www.blooddetective.com. So I hope to hear from you. We'll see you next week. Tell your friends. Be there. Take care, everybody.
Come out, Virginia. Don't let me wait. If you Catholic girl, start much too late. All the sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done.